Tonight we are going to talk about a figure who is arguably, probably the greatest enigma in the entire Torah. Probably. Because on one hand, Eliezer is spoken of in the rosiest of terms. Eliezer is grouped together with great tzaddikim. He's held in the highest esteem. And when Avraham Avinu, in this week's Torah portion, in Parshas Chayesara, after burying his wife, looks to the future and is concerned with his son Yitzchak and his Shidduch. So the Torah says in chapter 24, verse 2, Vayoymer Avraham el Avdoi. Avraham said to his servant, Zakan Beisai, the elder of his home, Hamoshel b'chol asher loy, who controls everything. And he said to him, Simna yodcho tachas yerechi, place your hand under my thigh. But before we talk about the placement of the hand, I should tell you that the Bereshis Rabbah, the Medrash says, that Avraham Avinu and this man, who incidentally is not named, in fact, Eliezer is never named specifically in the Torah. Even when it says, Uben Meshek Besi, Damesek Eliezer, even then there's a dispute whether Avraham Avinu refers to Eliezer, who will inherit him, who is not his flesh and blood, but a servant. According to many of the opinions, it's referring to Lot. It doesn't refer to Eliezer at all. And Eliezer looms very large in rabbinic literature. We speak of him. However, his name is actually not mentioned explicitly in the Torah. And in the most important mission that this Eliezer was ever given, I say the most important mission because assuming that it was Eliezer who was alluded to that helped Avraham Avinu when he went to war with the kings who captured his nephew, he was going together with Avraham Avinu. So his prowess was needed and his loyalty was appreciated, but he wasn't necessarily trusted. Here, Avraham Avinu trusts the future of the Jewish people, the future of world history, in fact, in the hands of a man who must be extremely righteous and trustworthy. I mean, Eliezer could come home with any girl. And if he coached her well enough, and she was a good actress, she could say she was anybody's relative. Avraham Avinu hadn't seen his relatives in many, many decades. Nobody had pictures of anybody. How could he know if this was a girl, if it wasn't? How would he ever prove if he did go to this place or didn't go to this place? This is an absolute situation of trust, total trust. And Avraham is deeply concerned. And we're told when Eliezer shows up, they say, oh, Baruch, blessed are you. They thought it was Avraham Avinu. And the Medrash Rabbah says that Zivu Kinon Shalei Daimelei, that Eliezer was such a loyal servant that he started to look like Avraham Avinu. His features changed. After years and years of devotion and commitment and dedication, even his physical features changed. Extraordinary person. Talking about an unbelievable chassid. That he actually took on the image of his Rebbe, of his master. The Gemara Maseches Yuma says that the meaning of Ha'meshel B'chol Asher Loi, that the person who controlled everything that belonged to him, the Gemara says, Eliezer, Eved Avraham, Zokin, V'yeshev B'yeshiva Hoya. The Gemara in Yuma on page 28 says that Eliezer was not simply an effective CEO, a person who could run Avraham Avinu's companies, but in fact he was a great scholar. He was a sage, he was an elder, he was steeped in the study of Torah, to the point that we say, Avraham Avinu calls him Zakan Beisai, Ha'meshel B'chol Asher Loi, that Eliezer, who, as it were, ruled over or controlled the teachings of his master. And that means adopting the idea in the Gemara of a maturgaman, of a translator, if you will, for lack of better terminology, that oftentimes people did not understand what Avraham Avinu was saying. And the one who understood Avraham Avinu, and the one who was able to convey his teachings, was Eliezer. So if there was one man who understood Avraham, his name is Eliezer. It's pretty impressive. HaMoshel B'chol HaShaloi, the Bereshis Rabba also says, he controls everything that is his, that he was able to control his evil inclination. Just like Avram had transformed himself, this man also transformed himself. Now, incidentally, the Torah doesn't give him a name here. It's interesting. It just says Avram calls Avdai, his servant, Zakan Basi, the elder of his home, HaMoshel B'chol HaShaloi. And then if you follow the conversation, it says, Vayemer ha'eved, the servant said, and we constantly hear a servant speaking. Until, in the middle of the conversation, if you follow along, if you follow along the trajectory of the conversation between Avraham Avinu and between the servant, Avraham calls the servant. And after Avraham Avinu calls the servant, we henceforth refer to him as the servant. When Avraham Avinu makes him take an oath, and he says, "Vashbiach b'Hashem elokei ha'shamayim, I make you take an oath, swear by the God of heaven, that you will not take a daughter mibneis Karkanani from the Canaanites here." So in verse 5 it says, Vayoymer Elov ha'eved, the Eved said to him. And then Avram responds in verse 6, and responds in verse 7, and responds in verse 8. And in verse 9 we're back to this man, we're going to call Eliezer. Vayosem ha'eved es yodai. The Eved places his hand, and the Eved, the servant, he takes an oath. Verse 10, Vayikach ha'eved, the servant takes. The servant goes. And then the servant prays. And then after the servant prays, what happens is his prayers are answered instantaneously. He says, Oysa hoychachta la'avdecha, this will prove to your servant. And then in verse 17, you could follow along. You see this all along. It says, Vayaratz ha'eved. The eved runs. And then after she gives him to drink, finally, in verse 21 verses into the story, suddenly he gets a name change. It says, "V'ha'ish mishtoila," the man wonders. He graduated, got an upgrade. 21 verses into the story, he's no longer an eved. Now he's a man. Now he's a mensch. What happened over here? Rabbeinu Bechaya maintains that Avraham Avinu had promised him, Hu yishlach malachai, he will send his angel, my angel. He'll send his angel. God will take care of you. And therefore, until Eliezer feels the angel is with him, he's an Eved. But the moment the angel starts to function with him, at this point when his prayers are answered, and now when he starts to wonder, now it's not Eliezer wondering by himself. Now it's the malach. Like Rabbeinu Bechaya says, it says later on, v'ha'ish gavriel. And we have a discussion about that with regard to Yosef when he meets the man. So over here it says it turns into Vahish. We talk about now a new being, Eliezer, all of a sudden became fused of two creatures. He became meshed like at one with an angel. That's pretty powerful stuff. Huh? What do I mean, an angel?
Angel, he mixed with angel?
That's what the Ben Bechaya basically says. That's why he gets a name change in the middle of the story. And he's just an Eved until a certain point. And at a certain point, he has an angel that's with him. He's no longer on his own. You want to call him possessed? You could call him possessed. Or you could call him that he has an infusion of strength. He has angelic strength with him. He has angelic. This man, Eliezer, who incidentally is identified in the Gemara as Eliezer, in at least two places in the Gemara. He's identified in the Yalkut Shimoni as Eliezer. He's identified in Pirkei Rabbi Elazar as Eliezer. Everybody identifies this servant, the servant in the story here, as Eliezer Eved Avram. But he never gets mentioned by the name Eliezer here. He's either called an Eved, or later from being called an Eved, from being called a servant of Avram, he becomes a Ish. He becomes a Mensch, because now he walks with a force, with a power that is greater than he. So we speak here of an extraordinary person. It's a person who has t- total control of his Yetzer Hara, a person who's an extraordinary Torah scholar, a person who actually started to look like Avraham Avinu because he was so loyal to Avraham. The Torah Shleima in his Agos brings down in the bottom when he speaks about the various virtues of Eliezer, he says that there's a sermon by Ibn Shu'ib who says that Eliezer was a great Chacham and he had wisdom in many, many different disciplines. So much so that he was able to know, to read Rivka's personality the moment he saw her, and even just watching her interact, he was able to see what an ordinary person couldn't see. And he was an exceptionally virtuous individual.
Was he married?
Was Eliezer married? Well, we're going to find out later that he has a daughter. So whether he is actually married now, meaning if his wife is alive, I don't know. But at some point he had to be married because he has a daughter. And he worried for that daughter.
The moment Abraham sent him, he was married?
Eliezer is a very old man with a daughter. I don't know what his wife's name is, and I don't know if he's married at this point. At some point he was married. This is very clear. He was a married man. He did have a family, or at least a daughter. When you take a look in the Achreinim, when they talk about Eliezer, first I'll share with you what's brought down. The Chizkuni says that Eliezer, first of all, the Radak says that he was the elder of Avram's house. He basically grew up in Avram's house. He knew nothing else. He was raised by Avram, as if he got old in Avram's house. And the Chizkuni goes on to say that he was a person who there was nothing to be concerned with. There was no suspicion of having him travel with a young girl. There was no suspicion. Whether because he was very old or because he was very righteous and very virtuous. Eliezer, when he's described, we hear of him being spoken of as Zakan Beisei, the elder of the home. We hear of him being spoken as the concept of Moishel B'chol HaShaloi, that he controls everything that Avram Avinu has. And we also hear of him being first we hear the Eved, Zakan Beisei, and Moishel B'chol Nyanei, the servant, the elder, and the one in control. So when you look in the commentaries, in the Rishonim and Achreinim, they have a lot to say about Eliezer. A lot of very positive things to say, a lot of very impressive things to say about him. For example, the Radak says that he was, from Avraham Avinu's entire household, the senior figure. And we know Avraham Avinu had thousands of converts. Avraham Avinu had a mini nation that followed him. He was like a king. He was looked at as a royal figure. And Eliezer was the senior and most superior of all of the people that followed Avraham Avinu. Or the Bechor Shor says that he actually got old in Avram's house, and that's why he's called Zakan Beisei, basically spent his whole life. From the time of his youth, he was with Avram Avinu. He almost didn't know anything else. All he knew was Avram and the ways of Avram. And Avram is tremendously influential. A person who was able to inspire thousands, tens of thousands of people. And this is a person who grew up his whole life in Avram's shadow. The Toldos Yitzchak, in his commentary, says that the three different terminologies or virtues of Eliezer is Avdai. That's on a very literal level, like the person who makes sure that his master mounts, gets off the horse, takes care of the what we're going to call transportation. Zakan Beisei, this means that he's the person who, in a sense, he understands the inner workings of everything that's going on. He says, like, you'll have a monarch, a royal figure. He'll have some people that are in charge of the technical and the literal menial work to make sure that, you know, things like transportation happen. And then you have a person who's like a senior advisor who understands the inner workings of the political machinations that the king has to deal with, and he's there at his right side to assist him, to help him. And finally, the Moishel, the ruler, means that he was effectively the one who managed Avraham Avinu's entire staff. Very virtuous. Could anybody argue that he's very virtuous? Would everybody agree with dealing with an exceptionally righteous person? We have a Gemara that tells us that there were three people, Shalosha Kafta Lahem Aretz. The Gemara in Sanhedrin and Daf Tzadikei says, three people in history, the earth wrinkled. I don't know what that means exactly, but essentially if a person would be walking here and he got to walk to here, it would take him a day, 2 days. So imagine if, as if the earth kind of wrinkled together, and Eliezer walked from one, and he walked straight to here. How everybody else didn't get smashed, I don't know, but that's the metaphor of a wrinkle in the earth. Kofzel Maderch means that the distance sprang. So it says, in history, in biblical history, there are three people about whom such a thing is said. And it's only three people. The Gemara says that it's Eliezer Eved Avraham, the Yaakov Avinu, the Avisha Ben Tzeruya. So we talk about a father, Jacob, the founder, if you will, of Beit Yisrael, or Beit Yaakov. The Jewish people are called the name of Yaakov Avinu. Avisha Ben Tzeruya, who is an extraordinarily important figure, a loyalist of David HaMelech, and Eliezer Eved Avraham. And then, on the other hand, you have a Medrash Yalkut Shimoni that speaks about the prayer of Eliezer. And the Bereishis Rabbo, the same thing it says. It says, there was Shloisha Himnenu B'mayne Pihem. There were three people who had a rapid response to their prayers. And who were those three people? Eliezer Eved Avraham, Moshe Rabbeinu, and Shlomo HaMelech. Keeps good company. Virtuous guy? Everybody agrees? Interestingly, his name is not mentioned. So what does Avraham Avinu want from this slave? He wants him to do something that he requires his trust for. And because he wants him to do something that he requires his trust for, he needs to exact an oath. And that's going back to verse 2. He says to Eliezer, after we hear about all these virtues, Simna yodcha tachas yerechi. I want you to place your hand under my thigh. So the Ibn Ezra says that once upon a time, when a servant was sent on a mission by his master, or the master wanted to remind the servant who's boss, he would say, put your hand here. I'm sitting on you now. You see who's boss? I'm sitting on you. In other words, this idea of was like a literal expression of dominion. You have to follow me. I'm sitting on top of you. That's the meaning of Simni Yodcha Tachas Yerechi. Now, he even goes on to say, and Maimonides quotes this in numerous sources, and it's found in Pirkei Derabbi Elazar and other places, that this was once a very widespread custom. And in fact, Maimonides maintains that in India, in his time, it was still practiced this way. That people who were serfs, people who were servants to a higher dominion, a higher individual, sometimes that they to demonstrate their loyalty, they would sit on their hands. So Ibn Ezra says, what's the problem? Avraham Avinu wants to emphasize the idea of I'm boss, which is very strange. I mean, Eliezer is this righteous guy who's learning Torah, and he's the senior of Avraham's house, and Avraham has to show him who's boss. He's to sit in his hand. So Rashi takes a different approach. Rashi says, Simno yodcha tachas yerechi, I want you to place your hand under my thigh. What does this mean? Chapter 24, verse 2. Rashi says, Lefi shahanishba tzarech sheyitol biyodoi chayfetz shel mitzvah. Because we know when a person takes an oath, he's supposed to hold on to a holy artifact, an object of a mitzvah. For example, kigoyin sefer Torah or tefillin, a Torah scroll or tefillin, or even in more modern times, to hold a chumash, or even to hold a holy book of Torah. In fact, there was a big dispute in the 19th century whether you could use a book of Zohar. And the Noda Yehuda's replacement, he issued a very sharp ruling that since we don't know for sure if the Zohar is real, you can swear on a Zohar. And then others responded very, very forcefully, and they proved that great Rishonim said the Zohar is the real deal, and you could swear on the Zohar. But the point is, like, a holy book. And from this, the secular world also has this custom when you go to court, and when you're going to take an oath, or when somebody is sworn into office, what do they have you do? You place your hand on a Bible, on a holy book. And in doing so, your oath becomes meaningful. And because maybe somebody won't want to do that, or doesn't believe in the Bible, so they say, okay, you can affirm. But principally and originally, the idea was that you actually would swear in a holy book, and that comes from us. That was the Jewish custom. So Rashi says, a sefer Torah or tefillin, as the Gemara says in Maseches Shavuos, v'hamila hoysa mitzvah reshein aloi. The milah, the bris milah, was the first mitzvah that Avraham Avinu had fulfilled. And because Avraham Avinu fulfilled this mitzvah, ubalei gam ayedei tzar, it also came to him through great pain. It was a painful mitzvah to fulfill. And we know the Mishnah tells us, lufum tzara agra, according to the pain is the gain. And if you expend effort and toil on doing a mitzvah, it's more valuable. So Avraham valued this mitzvah greatly. So therefore, ha'isa chaviva alav. And that's why he told the Eved, I want you to make an oath. I want you to put your hands near the Bris Milah. Now this does not mean, chas v'shalom, that Avraham Avinu had him touch his private parts, which could be interpreted in all kinds of strange ways, especially in these days. So the Gaon, the Psadja Gaon, who interpreted the entire Torah into Arabic in his time, because people didn't speak Aramaic anymore, so he translated the Torah into Arabic, and of course that doesn't work for most of us anymore, so somebody translated it back into Hebrew. But at any rate, it's not just a translation, it's really a commentary. In the commentary of Psadja Gaon, it says, Simna yodcha, kevin yodcha, noichach brisi. Place your hand near the Bris Milah. And the Abarbanel waxes on, and he explains that it doesn't mean, chas v'shalom, Abarbanel says clearly, loi, do not think, shetzivo, sheyikach biyadi evra mizgal, that he told him, literally, to hold his male organ. He says, cherpe hiloi, that's a terrible shame and embarrassment. Who would do such a thing? And that means, he says, yodei tachas hayoreach, put your hand under the thigh, which is close to that mitzvah. In other words, Ka'imer, says the Abarbanel, he was telling him, Zechor HaBris, I want you to remember. Do you remember the Brit Milah? Do you remember that we entered into a covenant with God? Incidentally, that was 41 years earlier. Eliezer was a servant in Avraham's house 41 years earlier when Avraham was 199. Now he's 140. When he's 199, that's when it was Simeon, they had this mitzvah of Brit Milah. And he says the reason he did this is because he wanted to make sure that Eliezer was not going to go behind his back and find some other girl and say, yeah, it's your family. I went all the way to where you wanted me to go and I brought her back and it's a member of your family. Really, how would Avraham know the difference? How would he know? He's 144. He left home at the age of 75. When was the last time he saw the members of his family? 65 years earlier. A lifetime earlier. How would he know? And Rivka, by the way, was 3 years old at the time. So he was born 62 years after he left. How would he know if it really was or really wasn't? And Eliezer could have found the easy way out. So therefore, Avraham Avinu makes him take the Shavua. And Abarbanel goes on to explain that the behavior of the Canaanite people was so soiled and so bad, it became part of the genetic makeup. Which incidentally, that idea, if you use the verbiage that he employs, it sounds almost like he's speaking about the field called epigenetics, which today has been proven. This is the breaking field of genetic research, that repetitive behavior, especially when it's repeated over generations, that it actually gets passed on in the genes. It actually becomes a part of who you are. So things like addiction, things like violence, things like cruelty, lack of compassion, these kind of things, if it's repetitively something that goes generationally, from generation to generation, eventually it actually works its way into the DNA. And then people have a preponderance, a predisposition to this kind of negative behavior. Abarbanel says, if you look at Avraham Avinu's family, who were they? Idolaters. They believed in all the wrong things. He says, believing in the wrong thing doesn't get passed down. What got passed down was belief. So Rivka believed in the right thing, and they believed in the wrong things. But it's not like bad behavior. Bad behavior, abusive behavior, obsessive behavior, behavior which is in effect the what becomes like a, no, what's it called?
What's the definition of that?
No, I'm talking about behavior when people can't control themselves. Addictive behavior. Addictive behavior, he says, this is something that does get passed on. The amazing thing is Abarbanel is writing this almost 800 years ago, 700 years ago. It actually is proven today. But he says something like who you believed in, that's not something that gets passed on from generation to generation. Avraham Avinu is extremely concerned about the future of the Jewish people. With whom will Yitzchak build a home? He doesn't even think Eliezer will or will not understand this, or will or won't want to, but essentially he needs to make sure Eliezer does the right thing. And that's why And that's why, if you take a look in Rashi, when he says, then he makes an oath, he says, I make you an oath, Balakeh Shamayim Velakeh Oretz. Rashi says, the God that was once God of heaven, now is the God who's God right here on earth. So the Abba Arbanel says, he's reminding him, remember, God is not just in the heavens, God is right here on earth. In other words, God's watching. And remember the Brit, and remember the covenant. So, really, he's still concerned that Eliezer might not do the right thing. Now, interestingly, later on, when Eliezer repeats the story, he tells the family of Rivka that I said to my master, Ulai, maybe she won't want to come with me. Like he's worried about that. And Rashi notes that when it says the word Ulai is spelled wrong. It's spelled Eli. So the question becomes, what is the Torah trying to tell us when it emphasizes this Eli? And Rashi goes on to say that Eliezer himself had a daughter. He asked him before if he was married. He had a daughter. And Eliezer had a dream. And his dream was that Yitzchak would marry his daughter. So Rashi says that the Ulai really is Eli, because Bas Hoysalele Eliezer, this is in Rashi, on chapter 24, verse 39, Rashi says, he was trying to find some kind of reason that Avram should give up on his ideas of going back to his home, and instead Avram should agree that his daughter should marry Eliezer. Amar le Avram, Avram says to him, Bini Baruch, my son is predisposed to blessings. Ata Ur, you're predisposed to curses. Ein Ur medabek b'baruch, not a good mix. Nothing to talk about. So, here Eliezer doesn't sound so good. Eliezer, we're now hearing that Avram is suspectful. Avram is employing mechanism to ensure that he doesn't deviate. Avram Avinu has to rebuke him and tell him that you are not necessarily, or necessarily not of blessed seed, and it is not through you whom the Jewish people could be built. And what essentially adds up here is that Avram doesn't seem to trust Eliezer that much. He's very virtuous. He's very special. He's a senior figure. But Avram Avinu is actually not trustworthy, not trusting of him. Now, there is another time in the Torah that an oath is administered. And this takes us all the way to the end of the book of Genesis. Anybody remember when? An oath is administered by a patriarch?
To take his bones.
When Yaakov, our father Jacob, wants to make sure that Yosef is going to fulfill his desires, he calls him over, and this is the second time we have the same thing. He says to Yosef, I am going to die. And because I'm going to die, he says, I want you to make an oath. I want you to swear that you are going to transport my body to the Holy Land. Chapter 48, you have the book, it's Bereishis. Chapter 48, verse 30, it says, V'shachavti im avoisai, I will lie with my fathers. Unsosani b'mitzrayim, you will then take me from the land of Egypt. Ukvartani b'kvurasam, and you will bury me in their grave. V'yoyimar, what does Yosef say? When his father says, I want you to make sure that you bury me together with my ancestors in Hebron. So what does Yosef say? He says, yes. Anoichi eseh chidvarecha. I will do as you ask. Vayomer, and Yaakov says, Yishavali. Swear. And he says, Vayishavali. And only after he swears, then Vayishtach Yisal Reishamita. Now that's in verse 30. If you go back to verse 29, the Torah there says, Vayikra levno lo Yosef. A father Jacob calls his son Joseph. Vayomer, he says, Nomatzasi chen beinecho, if I find favor in your eyes, Simno yodcho tachas yereichi. The same verbiage used by Avram and Eliezer. I want you to make an oath. V'asisa imadi, chesed v'emes, do with me truth and kindness. Al nosig v'reni b'mitzroyim. Don't bury me here. But instead, you should take me. So what did Yosef say when his father said, I want you to swear? What did he say? I'll do it. Esek et varecha. Yaakov said, that's not good enough. I want you to take that oath. And when this happens, everybody explodes. What's going on here? Yosef wasn't trusted by his own father. Why did he insist that he had to swear? And especially that he had to make him swear by a bris milah. Like the story of Avraham Avinu is, it was his first mitzvah, and it was something that came with great pain, and he's reminding Eliezer of the oath you made. But now, it's none of the above. And the Maharal of Prague, the Gurari, in his commentary on Rashi says that essentially at this point, the reason that Yaakov is administering an oath to Yosef is not because he doesn't trust Yosef, but rather because he doesn't trust the Pharaoh. He doesn't think the Pharaoh will be honest. He doesn't think the Pharaoh will allow Yosef to take his body out. And therefore, he makes sure that Yosef is going to swear using the convention of the day. So when the Pharaoh will say, you don't have to keep your word, Yosef will say, I took an oath. And we'll soon see in a moment, Rashi actually talks about this later. So the famous question is, why was Yaakov suspectful? Why did Yaakov even have reason for concern? After all, Hashem promised, Anoichi, A'alcha gam oloi, earlier in chapter 46, verse 4, Hashem promises Yaakov, I will bring you up. If Hashem promised, I will bring you up, did Yaakov doubt that he would go up? So the Riva says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised him he'd go up. Yosef also eventually goes up. The rest of the tribes also eventually go up to Eretz Yisrael. When? A long time later, in a coffin. But not just post-mortem, but instead of just simply post-mortem, like 2 centuries later. So Yosef says, Yaakov says, that's not going to work. Not in 2 centuries. Not in 100 years from now. I want you to take me now. And that's why he makes him swear. And the Ramban says, how could it be that our father Jacob was suspectful of his son Joseph, that he didn't trust him? And he says, impossible to perish the thought, he says, impossible to imagine this. Bevadai lechoshad Yaakov, he was sure without a doubt, Yaakov had no suspicion whatsoever about his son. So why did he make him swear? Again, Ramban says the same thing. He was worried about the Pharaoh. That the Pharaoh would try to make sure that Jacob gets buried in the land of Egypt. Why? Because they saw Jacob as like an amulet, a good luck charm. They say it was a prophet. God spoke to him. And therefore, having his body buried in Egypt would be a good thing for Egypt. It would be a pride and joy of Egypt. It would bring Egypt blessing. And so the Pharaoh would come to Yosef and say, it's an issue of national concern. It's an issue of Egyptian welfare. This is a federal issue. This is not a private family issue. Because it's federal. Because it's government. And because it's the welfare of the nation. And because our economy depends on this. How could you do otherwise? And he would bring all kinds of pressures to bear. And because of this, that's why he emphasizes you have to take an oath. Rabbeinu Bechaya says, because Yosef was in a position of tremendous leadership and responsibility in Mitzrayim. And because he was in a position of leadership and responsibility, it would look oxymoronic if Yosef, who's the one responsible for the welfare of Egypt, himself undermines the country and undermines the welfare of the country. Yaakov was a pretty smart guy. Because guess what happens? After he goes ahead and he swears, interestingly, first of all, it says, Vayishova lo. It should say Vayishova. He swear. It says, Yishova li, swear to me. And then it says Vayishova. He says, swear to me. Vayishova, he swore. No, it says, Yishova li. The Pasuk says, Vayishova lo. He swore to him. And the Kliyakar says, this was a private oath. There was nobody witnessing this. It wasn't publicly documented. Why? Because it was an embarrassment that a father Jacob should have to make Yosef take an oath. Is an embarrassment. It's an embarrassment. It's not nice. It doesn't look good. So this was a private affair. It was so that Yosef would later have the strength to deal with the challenges that the Pharaoh would throw at him in the post-mortem of a father Jacob's passing and the period of mourning. And actually, if you take a look in the very end of the book, when we speak of the passing of our father Jacob in chapter 50, and then in verse 4 it says, the days of national mourning came to a close. And then Yosef goes to the Pharaoh who probably had all these dreams and designs on where they would bury Jacob and what national shrine they would make his grave into. And Yosef begins his remarks and he says, Anoichi hishbi'ani lemer. I took an oath saying, my father made me do this. Avi hishbi'ani. He doesn't say I took an oath. My father made me take an oath. He forced me to take an oath. He says, I'm going to die. I want you to bring me to my grave. The grave, Asher Koriti li ba'aretz, which according incidentally to some of the Rishonim means, Yaakov himself, before he left the land of Israel, actually dug himself a grave. He had everything prepared. He didn't rely on anybody. He dug the grave himself, he had everything prepared, and then he made Joseph take an oath. Now the Gemara, of course, tells us that if not for this oath, there would have been some very, very serious problems. What does the Pharaoh say? The Pharaoh says to Joseph, he says, Alei ukvor et avicha ka'asher hishbi'echa. Go and bury your father as he made you swear. In other words, had he not made him swear? V'imloi b'shvil ha'shavua, says Rashi, if he had not sworn, lo ha'yisa manichacha, then he wouldn't allow him to do it. So why did Pharaoh all of a sudden respect oaths? Says Rashi, Yorei Loimar Avoir al Hashavua. He was a little bit worried, he was concerned, he was fearful to tell Yosef, violate your oath. Why? Because then Yosef will say, ah, so we're not bound by oaths? I don't have to keep oaths that I took? Oh, in that case, I can tell everybody, Agala, I can reveal that you don't know how to speak the Hebrew tongue. This is the Gemara of Maseches Sota. And contrary to popular belief, Egypt was a country that was steeped in immorality. And Egypt was a country in which the civilization kind of functioned and it was driven by sensual pleasure. But Egypt was also a country of tremendous intelligence and tremendous innovation. It was the cutting edge of all kinds of intellectual endeavor. And in order to be the ruler of a country like this, you had to earn the people's respect. And you earned the people's respect by being able to converse or be conversant in every language. You had to communicate in every way possible. And so, the Gemara tells us that when Joseph was tapped for a position of leadership, the people started mumbling and murmuring and saying, he's a slave. How's he going to rule? And it says that miraculously an angel taught Joseph enough, I don't know if he could speak the languages, but enough to be conversant. He could respond in any language. And incidentally, there's a medrash that says that the Pharaoh sat on a tall throne and you could only come as close or ascend as many stairs as languages you could speak. And Yosef went step after step after step after step and he came to the highest step. And there he began to speak to the Pharaoh in Hebrew and the Pharaoh could not respond. And being high up on this chair, far away from everybody else, the Pharaoh whispered to Joseph, make an oath you will never tell anybody I can't speak Hebrew. Because this will make him look really bad. Incidentally, in Temple University in Philadelphia, they have probably one of the world's best Egyptology sections in their museum. In the Temple University Museum, they have the original throne room, portions of the original throne room of one of the pharaohs of that time. They have the original pillars. And I remember being a boy. We lived in Philadelphia. Then we visited Temple University. And I had studied this Chumash. And they actually had a model in the middle of this throne room, the layout of the throne room, of what they approximate the throne room looked like. In the middle, there's a wood model. And incredibly, the Pharaoh's throne was at the end of many, many, many stairs. Exactly as it imagined it as a child learning in school. Apparently it was the real deal. That's documented. So the Pharaoh was concerned that Joseph would renege on his vow if he had to renege on a vow now. And therefore, the Pharaoh allows Yosef to go free, so to speak, and bury his father as he had promised. Now, I ask you, my friends, a simple question. When Eliezer is sent on a mission, our father Avram makes him take an oath. Nobody asked the question, why didn't he trust him? Nobody asked the question, for whom was the oath? Everybody seems to understand that it made perfect sense that Eliezer should have to take the oath. And if Eliezer wouldn't take the oath, Avram Avinu couldn't trust him. Only after the oath is administered, and only after Avraham Avinu brings the beer, and he puts the pressure on him, and he tells him, remember who you are, remember the Brit, and remember this oath, only then is Avraham Avinu secure enough to be able to trust him. And conversely, at the end of the book, when Joseph has to take an oath, it's like a different world. Everybody explodes in protest. How could this be? Why is Joseph taking an oath? It doesn't make any sense. And even when he does take an oath, he takes the oath in private, it's not in public, and nobody knows about it. Is it only me? Do you see a disparity between Eliezer and between Yosef? Same book, same words, same kind of oath. With Eliezer, it seems to be self-understood this oath was required. Abarbanel even has to go into the details of explaining why the oath has to be administered. When it comes to Yosef, nobody sits quietly. And everybody seems to have to create a rationale as to why the oath has to be administered. And ultimately, Pharaoh gets all the blame. But Yosef himself did need the oath. So if Eliezer is so virtuous, if he's such a big tzaddik, why does he need an oath? So clearly, the enigma of Eliezer is not so simple. Eliezer's righteousness, if you will, or Eliezer's virtues, if you will, can easily be called into question. And in order to understand this, I think it's important that now you should find out who Eliezer really was. And when you'll hear who he was, and you'll hear where he came from, maybe you'll see why Avraham Avinu trusted, but not entirely, only after taking an oath. Let me begin by quoting to you the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. The Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer in chapter 16 asks the question I just asked. It says, quote, Zakan Beito Shel Avraham, the elder of the house of Avram, indisputably, from various Gemaras and Midrashim, everybody agrees, Hoya Avdai was his servant, Eliezer. So he asks, Ume Ayin Hoya Avdai. How did he get this slave? How did he get this servant? We know Avram Avinu had acolytes. We know Avram Avinu had followers. We know Avram Avinu had disciples. When did Avraham Avinu pick up a servant? Where did the servant come from? It sounds, in fact, as if Avraham Avinu did not have other servants. It sounds like this is the servant. So the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer says, Kivan sheyatza me'ur kastim. Long, long before Avraham Avinu gets the command of Lech Lecha. And he's still a young man, in his 40s. When he was thrown into a fiery furnace, what happened? Clearly, he didn't get burnt. So in Ur Kasdim, the man whose name is Nimrod throws him into a fiery furnace. And then he emerged unscathed. Amdu kol gedolei hadar v'nosnu lematanis. All of the famous people of that generation came to pay tribute to Avram, because nobody had ever seen something like that happen. Omad Nimrod. Nimrod came along. V'kosaves avdo Eliezer l'Avram, he transferred his personal servant, Eliezer, who grew up in Nimrod's house, to Avram Avinu. U'kishagom al chesed im Yitzchak b'noi, when Eliezer faithfully discharged his mission and did this kindness for Yitzchak, hoitzir l'chedros, Avram Avinu freed him. V'nosan l'hakadosh baruch hu schorei ba'olam hazeh, God repaid him in this world because he had in fact behaved righteously. And Hashem doesn't want the reward of the wicked in the world to come. And therefore, says the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, V'hikim l'melech, he later was established as a monarch. V'hu, are you listening? Og melech habashan. Eliezer, says the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, is Og Melech HaBashan. Og Melech HaBashan. The man who is the enemy of the Jewish people. The man who Moshe Rabbeinu slays. The man who survived the Mabul, it seems. As we know, it says, Ach, Vayishor, Ach, Noyach. That's going back to the beginning of the book of Genesis, where Noach's floating barge is working quite well. Everybody else is gone. Everybody else is dead. But Noach, he's still floating. And it says that the water became more and more powerful, and everybody died. And in Genesis 8, verse 23, it says, Vayishor ach noyach. And what does it mean, Vayishor ach noyach? It should say, Vayishor noyach vasharitei. Who was left? Noach, and who was with him? Says the Baal HaTurim, l'rabbis, this includes Og. Og, who was left over from the Mabul. The Baal HaTosfos say, ach noyach, when you add up all the gematria of ach noach, you get 79. Because ach is 21, and noach is 58. 21 and 58 gives you 79. And the name Og, ayin is 70, vav is 6, gimel is 3, and that equals 79. This is a very old guy. So this Og manages to survive the Mabul, really the only survivor. He later is in the world wars that Avraham Avinu gets mixed in, and we hear about Vayavai HaPolit. And when Vayavai HaPolit, when the Polit comes to tell Avraham Avinu that, that Lot was captured, so we're told, who is the Polit? I'll just give you the actual words. Vayavid HaPolit, Vayagid Lavram Avinu, which is chapter 14, verse 13 of the book of Genesis. Let's take a look inside. And there it says that the Polit came and he told Avraham, who is the Polit? Well, Yaakov Shemani says a guy named Polit. We don't know who he is. However, Rashi says the Polit is literally some guy who survived the war. However, he says this is the meaning of Rak Oig Nisher Meyeser Refoyim. And so this fellow was actually Og. And that's what the Bereishis Rabba says. The Bereishis Rabba, the Medrash says, who Og? Who Polit? Og and Polit are the same person. And why is his name Og? Because he came and found Avraham Avinu making matzah, which is called Ugot. And therefore, he there was called Og. So we have this Vayishar Ach Og from the Mabul. We have a story later on with Avraham Avinu, where he seems to come with the wrong intentions. And then we have a Pirkei Der Belezer saying that in fact, he is Og Melech HaBashan. All right, so I did find the Torah Shleimah wants to suggest that there may be historically two Og king of Bashans. And there was, so it's not, I don't have this exactly clear, but there was Og the wicked, and then Og who wasn't wicked. And Og the wicked is killed by Moshe, but there was another Og who wasn't so wicked, and he was also a king, and that Og is Eliezer. I don't have a better answer, I don't know, but I'm telling you what the Pirkei Der Belezer says. So far we know that he was a servant of Nimrod, and we think he later may be the guy we call Og. Now let me tell you what the Targum Yonis and Ben Uziel says. In Parshas Lech Lecha, when Avraham Avinu goes to war against those kings who had captured his nephew. So it says that Avraham Avinu took with him some young lads, and it says they went out to war together. Says the Pirkei Der Belezer, what is the meaning of Vayorek Eschanichov? That he took those who he had educated. He took his acolytes, and he went off to war. Yilid Beisai, Shmein Asav Vashalish Meis, 318 people, Vayir Defadon. Says the Pirkei Der Belezer, the chonich lekrava mirabanaya besa, those who had become skilled or learned in warfare, and who was that? Ubacha min choin yas Eliezer bar Nimrod, Eliezer the son of Nimrod, dahava mitzil bigvurte, who was very powerful. Nimrod was a powerful warrior. Nimrod's son seems also as a powerful warrior. So now in keeping with the Pirkei de Rabbi Elazar, but yet in not keeping. In Pirkei de Rabbi Elazar, he's called a servant, and here he's called an actual son. The Chizkuni, in his commentary, says that a little bit later, in verse 15, it says, they chased the enemy all the way, Vayir defame, ad chova, Hashem Yismoyle damasek. So he says, why are you giving us a location here? Because he says, Sham dorim b'nei mishpachte shel Eliezer. Eliezer's family lived there. And this is why he's called Damasek Eliezer. And the family of Eliezer assisted, which is very strange. Because it turns out that Nimrod had cousins living in Damasek. And when Nimrod was in trouble, they sided with Nimrod's son, not with Nimrod. Incidentally, the question is asked, how could Nimrod's son, if he was a loyal follower of Avraham Avinu, and he followed the monotheistic path, how could he go to war against his father? Doesn't he have a responsibility to respect his father? And the answer that's given is that when is this the case? When a person is not what's called, quote, a mesis or mediach, somebody who tries to get others to worship idols. But when somebody tries to get others to worship idols, he forfeits his rights, and as such, it's finished. He's no longer, he has to have any responsibility, and that's why Eliezer, who was righteous, go to war with his father, who was Nimrod. The Chizkuni, a page later, says, Damasek Eliezer, he says, Ben Beno Shal Nimrod Harasha Haya. He's not a son, he's a grandson. So now we think he's a son. Now we think he's a grandson, and now we think he's a servant. Three different sources which seem to indicate that he is connected to Nimrod. We just don't know how he's connected to Nimrod. To make matters even stranger, we have a Medrash Rabbah. And Medrash Rabbah talks about who Eliezer was. The same Medrash Rabbah that I shared with her earlier, that they said, Boy Baruch Hashem. Oh, he said, when Eliezer came, they said, be blessed in the name of God. And that they thought that he was Avram, that he looked like Avram. The next statement in the Medrash is, Amar Rabbi Yosi b'Rabbi Doisa, Kenan hu. He's Kenan. Who's Kenan? Shem Chum Yofes. Who's Kenan? Kenan was the son of Chum, who castrates Noach. Who Noach curses. So this is Kenan, is Eliezer. Val Yedei Shesheder Seis Tzadik, because he served this tzadik loyally, Be'emuna Yatsa Miklal Arur Miklal Baruch. The curse that Noach gave was undone by the later on because of his service to Avraham Avinu. Now this is getting really hard to understand. So now he could be Nimrod's son. Now he could be Nimrod's grandson. Now he could be Nimrod's servant. Now he could be Og Melech HaBashan. And now he can be Kenan himself. So the commentary on the Medrash has a very interesting perspective on this. Kenan, it says, does not mean he's actually Kenan. Kenan means he's from the family of Kenan. And the word Kenan or Kenani means sometimes a deceitful business person. As we see in the book of Hosea, chapter 12, verse 8, it says, Kenan biyodo ma'ozne mirma la'ashok ohev. Kenan is basically, call it business if you will, or trafficking, but he's a business person who has ma'ozne mirma, deceitful scales in his hands, and the reason is la'ashok ohev, because he loves to oppress. So from the book of Hosea, it seems that Kenan is not necessarily the person Kenan, but Kenan is a way of life. Kenan is an attitude. Kenan is an approach. Kenan is a way of dealing. And so some of the commentaries in the Medrash seem to indicate that there's not actually Kenan, but rather from the seed of Kenan, which we know that Nimrod is from the seed of Kenan. So the seed of Kenan and the seed of Chum, which was cursed, was able to be undone because of the loyal service to Avraham Avinu. So I just want to suggest that it's possible that when we say that he was a son or a grandson, that this is actually interchangeable, because we have this idea that ben b'noi harei uke b'noi, a grandchild could sometimes be considered like a child. But why would he call him a servant? It's possible, in fact, it's extremely likely that Nimrod had many wives, as was the custom of powerful people in those days. And it's also likely and extremely possible that Nimrod not only had sons, but he also had concubines. And so this servant could have been the son or grandson of a maidservant of Nimrod, who he had inducted in as a servant of his, considered him to be inferior. And because he considered him to be inferior or a servant, he had the genetics of Nimrod. But whether he's a son or a grandson, or whether he's a servant, doesn't necessarily have to be a contradiction. And the idea that he's Og Melech HaBashan, I don't understand that, but that you could just say there's two Ogs. But at any rate, what we are getting a kind of picture is that Eliezer is not so virtuous as we think he is. Relative to who he was, and relative to where he came from, he accomplished a great deal. But ultimately, Avraham Avinu is always afraid that he's going to be reverting back to being who he always was. So when you have this kind of perspective, here is something very interesting. The Medrash before tells us that there were three people whose prayers were answered instantaneously. And the three people were Eliezer, Moshe Rabbeinu, and Shlomo HaMelech. So the Rebbe famously asks a question, like, is Eliezer as great as Moshe Rabbeinu? Like, how did he merit to be one of the three greats? Nobody ever would suggest Eliezer, Moshe, and Shlomo HaMelech, the three greats, the ones who are the most powerful individuals when it comes to davening. Nobody prayed as powerfully as they did. So the Rebbe takes a totally different approach to that Medrash. And the Rebbe says, it's not about the individuals who prayed, but rather what they were praying for. Because the Medrash does not tell us that every time Moshe Rabbeinu prayed, he was answered instantaneously. And the Medrash doesn't tell us every time that Shlomo HaMelech prayed, he was answered instantaneously. It's a specific event. The event which Shlomo HaMelech was after the Beis HaMikdash was built, and Shlomo HaMelech prayed that the Shekhinah should dwell in the Beis HaMikdash. And before he finished speaking, the Shekhinah dwelt in the Beis HaMikdash in a manifest way. Moshe Rabbeinu was faced with one of the greatest challenges of his life when Korach and his men led a mutiny against Moshe Rabbeinu. And they maintained that Bada Moshe Meliboy, that Moshe Rabbeinu made it up by himself, that Moshe Rabbeinu was not really speaking in the name of God, that people are people, and despite the fact that there is some kind of revelation, and God sometimes may indicate what he wants, it doesn't mean that Moshe Rabbeinu actually is a vehicle or mechanism for divine diffusion. God's not speaking through Moshe. And Moshe prays, and before Moshe finished praying, what happens? The ground opens up, and these people are swallowed up. And then, of course, there's the case of Eliezer. So the Rebbe says, in Chassidus it's explained that the story of Eliezer, which is repeated not once, but twice in the Torah, in all of its details. And Rashi famously commenting the Medrash Amar Rebbe Acha says, Yofa sichosen shel avdei oves, yesu mitirosen shel banim, that the common casual speech of the servant of the patriarchs is greater than the Torah of the children, which on the surface is very strange. It's not the children's Torah, it's God's Torah. How can it be when God tells us keep the Shabbat, he doesn't even tell us what he means? He tells us to put on tefillin, he never tells us what he means. And we have to derive these things from an oral tradition. And yet when it comes to the story of Rivka and Yitzchak, when it comes to that for Shidduch Eliezer's mission, the Torah repeats it in great detail twice. So on the surface, people think it's the virtue of Eliezer. Eliezer was more virtuous than Bonim, than the children through whom Hashem gave the Torah. But that's a tragic mistake. Chas v'shalom. What it means is that that casual speech undermines, or if you will, undergirds the essence of what creation is all about. The Alter Rebbe and the Mittler Rebbe explain at length in the Maimorim that the union of Yitzchak and Rivka represents an extraordinary coming together of polar opposites. Yitzchak comes from the holiest parents, the first one in the world to be born a Jew. Yitzchak is a person whose mother can't conceive him if she laughs or doesn't take the possibility of an extraordinary miracle seriously. And that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu, after Sarah Imenu laughs, HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes and he tells Avram, your wife laughed. And Avram has to go confront her. And she says, no, I didn't. But the message gets through. And 6 months later, Sarah Imenu can become full pregnant after she knows HaYipolim HaShem Davar. And Yitzchak is born in the most perfect spiritual situation. And his mother, Sarah, zealously protects his innocence and his future upbringing. even if it means throwing Yishmael out on his head. And then he becomes an oilo tmima. Then he becomes an offering. And Yitzchak is considered to be the most perfect specimen of humanity. And Rivka, on the other hand? Rivka comes from people who are idolaters, liars, cheaters, lowlifes. Besuel plans to poison Eliezer, and that's why it says the Malachim switch the plates. Besuel ends up poisoning himself, and Eliezer is able to continue functioning. Lavan is a liar and a cheater, as we see, has to deal with Yaakov, tries to fool Yaakov, threatens to kill his own children. A monster. And Rivka comes in this situation, and she has to be literally plucked from the situation. Like it says, Kishashana ben Achoichim, like a thorn, like a rose growing in a thorn bush. Surrounded by thorns is the solitary rose. Rivka has to be plucked from the midst of this horrible behavior. And this, they're going to be coming together, Yitzchak and Rivka. And this idea of Yitzchak and Rivka coming together actually is paradigmatic of what we call the concept of Yichudim Elyonim. That God creates what seems to be different planes, different realities. And the job of a Yid is to try to bring that together. The job, the task that's given to us is to try to fuse these opposites. Just as we bring body and soul together, Hashem brings body and soul together, that our task is to infuse the material, the ordinary, the mundane, with the sacred and the holy. And this is called the concept of Yichud. Yichud el Yayin v'tachtayin, bringing together heaven and earth. Of which a marriage is a paradigm of the greatest kind of opposites, bringing opposites together. And when you fuse these opposites, as they famously say, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, or whoever that goes, and you can bring that together, then you're able to bring the next generation into the world, which is the concept, as Chassidus speaks of it, is the infinitude amongst finite human beings. That in theory, we could procreate ad infinitum. And procreation and bringing the next generation into the world requires this sense of union. And Yitzchak and Rivka's shidduch, which is the first shidduch, the first match ever spoken of in the Torah, ever happening in Jewish history, becomes the paradigm. It becomes, if you will, the blueprint for all of the future of the Jewish people. And that's why we have these phenomenal midrashim with Rashi quoting it in a literal level, that the jewelry that Eliezer is giving Rivka is reflective of the events that will happen at Mount Sinai. And it's somehow that the union of Yitzchak and Rivka will represent the marriage of heaven and earth and God and the Jewish people later on when the Torah is going to be given to us. So really and truly, the reason that we say there was three people who were answered instantaneously is not because of Eliezer's virtue, but because of the importance of Eliezer's mission. Eliezer was the beginning of a process. Bringing Yitzchak and Rivka together is the concept of bringing heaven to earth. And so Hashem responds to his prayer instantaneously. Moshe Rabbeinu being a prophet, Moshe Rabbeinu being able to rise to the level that Shechina Medaberes, that the Shechina speaks to, or speaks to his voice box, this is the idea of Moshe Rabbeinu becoming seamlessly fused onto HaKadosh Baruch Hu, where he becomes totally transparent, if you will, a Beis HaMikdash of sorts. As the Drasha Saran says in his seventh sermon, where he speaks about the Beis HaMikdash, and he speaks about Tzaddikim in the same breath. And he says the Beis HaMikdash is a place where people were able to receive prophecy if they were predisposed to it. And he says to be in the presence of a tzaddik is like being in that same place. To being in the presence of a tzaddik, to being in the presence of a prophet, he says, is like being in the presence of the Beis HaMikdash. It's like the Beis HaMikdash is the cell phone tower and the tzaddik would be the hotspot. And then there's Eliezer. And Eliezer's mission is the beginning of that process. And that's why Eliezer gets answered instantaneously. And that's why for Eliezer, this kfitzas haderech, the earth wrinkles, or earth sheds its limitations. Not because of Eliezer's virtue, but because of the importance of Eliezer's mission. So in closing, the fact that Eliezer seems to be included with extraordinarily virtuous people, and the fact that Eliezer seems to keep very fine company, does not mean that Eliezer is actually in the greatest Jewish Hall of Fame. He's not necessarily the greatest figure of all time. It's just that in this particular moment, Eliezer plays a role of extraordinary magnitude. And because he played that role, that's why he gets a lot of, if you will, he gets a lot of good rap. Like he's in the company of extraordinary people. Because Eliezer is poised to be able to bring something about which is unique, and has a lasting impact. And in truth, it's pretty clear that despite the fact that Eliezer had many virtues, that Eliezer, to some degree, Avram didn't trust fully. He could only trust him after administering the oath. He could only trust him after ensuring that Eliezer would promise to be who he had said he would be. Whereas when it comes to Yaakov and Yosef, it's a different story altogether. Yosef is Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef is that virtuous individual. The Simna Yodcho Tachas Yerechi here provokes no question and no wonderment or amazement. The Simna Yerechi Tachas Yodcho, when the same thing happens with Yaakov and Yosef, this ensues or brings forth protest. And that's the enigma of Eliezer, son of Nimrod, or grandson of Nimrod, maybe servant of Nimrod, Canaan or Og Melech HaBashan, whoever he was, Eliezer himself was relatively a very fine individual. However, in the grander scheme of things, he isn't that important a guy. However, he did a very important thing. And the reason Eliezer gets the credit he gets is not because of who he was, but because of the role he played. And that should make us realize that even if we're just little people, and even if we aren't extraordinarily virtuous, and even if we don't necessarily have the power to do unbelievable things, HaKadosh Baruch Hu could put us in a spot where we are given an extraordinary mission. Like the Rambam says, that one should see himself at every single moment of life as if the scales of the world are proverbially balanced, and if you have perfectly balanced scales, a single mitzvah can weigh the scales down. So you have to realize that the weight of the world is on your shoulders. Not because you're so fantastic, but because for whatever reason, sometimes an ordinary person is put into extraordinary circumstances, and when that happens, he's given the koyach. And I'll finish with the idea that a shavua, an oath, is also connected to the notion of an empowerment. Because it says, Mashbiyan Eisei, that before a child is born, an oath is administered, he should be a tzaddik. And the Alter Rebbe famously asks, of what value is the oath that the baby is administered if we don't even remember taking that oath? How could it be meaningful? So the Alter Rebbe explains that the word shavua, which means oath, can also be interchanged with the word savua, which means satiated. You just have to move the dot. You move the dot from the right of the shin to the left, it becomes savua. And when Avraham Avinu administers an oath to Eliezer, Eliezer is empowered by Avraham. And when Eliezer is empowered by Avraham, Avraham sends his angels along. And when Avraham Avinu sends his angels along, at some point, he's no longer, like Rabbeinu Bechaya says, Vayoymer ha'eved, all of a sudden he becomes a mensch. All of a sudden he's Vaha'ish mishtohe. And for the rest of the narrative, he's no longer an eved. For the rest of the narrative, now that Gavriel, Hamalach, is holding his hand, all of a sudden he gvar na mensch. And he doesn't forget that. Because when he's asked to introduce himself, who are you? He could have said, me? You wonder who I am? My dad was Nimrod. Pretty impressive. Well, my granddad was Nimrod. Or he could have said, you know who I am? You ever hear of Og? Or you ever hear of a guy who escaped? He had like a whole history. When Eliezer is asked to introduce himself, what does he say? Eved Avraham Anoichi. I'm a servant of Avraham. That's all I am. What's the incredible thing about Eliezer? Is his bittul. Is his ability to transcend himself. To forget about who he was, and instead to focus on who he has been put in the position to be. Not as an individual, not as somebody who is independent of his master, but understanding that he walks with the shavua, with the oath that Hashem has given him. And when you walk with the oath that's given to you, when you're an agent of Avraham Avinu, Eved Avraham Anoichi, so then, Eved Melech Melechu. He's the servant of a king, he becomes a monarch, he becomes a king. And that's how Eliezer is able to carry out what is arguably one of the most important and vital missions in all of Jewish history. And with this, we shall conclude.